We all tell ourselves stories of who we are and why. But we forget that we have the power to define them. That no idea grows from mewling striped cub to teeth at your throat tiger without a little help, some guidance, and a whole lot of love along the way. I'm Jared Cerf, and this is Here Be Tigers.
The only other thought I had for the trial, the game of lawyers, is some form of system to keep the case being mobile. The chances are the system is it's not so much that you know the storyline going in, but that the defendant has certain stats that will come into play. So like three stats they might have would guilt, misfortune, and vigor. Guilt is how guilty they actually are.
My gut impulse as you were describing the qualities of the defendant was to crack open a box of Fun Employed and draw three cards.
Well, now we're getting closer to what I think is going to be like a system for the final one. The final one is unlike the other two. The other two that I just read are more, you're playing a character, like your standard thing. You're playing a character or you're playing a team. This next one is more of a world building exercise. And the idea behind it is, well, there are a lot of stories and a lot of worlds where there are these really powerful artifacts that the history of the world, or at least a large chunk of the history of the world, revolves around or has been massively influenced by. I'm thinking things like the One Ring or the Master Sword. And they can also be, I expanded it out a little bit from the initial idea was purely artifacts, but prophecies also would work in this case.
Right, it is a thing that is a constant, although from what I understand of the Tears of the Kingdom era Link games, the one major quality of the Master Sword is that it self-repairs.
Yes.
So you can't actually break the artifact unlike everything else you wield in those games.
Right. And in fact, the Tears of the Kingdom, in one sense, has made it significantly more powerful, because one of the elements of it is that the longer it sits in goodness or purity or grace or whatever you want to call it, light, the stronger it gets. And then if you can deplete that battery down, but there isn't a cap on how strong it gets. If it's allowed to rest in those conditions.
So it provides you with an incentive and a condition to play either against or toward. And in a way, I mean, the reason I bring it up as well as you is that this is a franchise-spanning relic, artifact, if you want to call it that. But its qualities, as expressed within various forms of the game and the stories told in them, changes.
And that is the key point. The idea I had was, the very initial seed idea this came from was, what if there's a game where your artifacts grow, like your weapons grow as you use them, and then based on how you use them, they start taking on aspects. And then I quickly was like, well, let's drop the idea of you being the character. Let's start the idea that you being the artifact.
What if you're the most interesting thing in the story instead of the side piece?
Exactly. But it is still a play to find out what happens and what is. So you start out, the idea is you are definitely this powerful artifact, but what kind of power your artifact is, you as the player don't know yet. You know some of it. You can choose certain things like, what kind of artifact, a ring, a sword, a prophecy.
Sure.
And some basic things that it does, like it might be, again, it's a ring that conceals, or a sword that binds, or a prophecy of doom, all that kind of thing. But you don't know what. And so this is the one I have the most developed, and where that Fun Employed thing actually kind of comes in. Because the idea is you get to, people take turns laying out scenes, some moment in history where that artifact was a part of what was going on. And you just try to make the story interesting with what you already have, even if at the beginning it's just, oh, hey, it's a sword that shoots fire or something like that.
It sounds like, because fundamentally, the object itself, even if it has properties and has history and legend and mythology around it,
and you're trying to build that mythology. Right. As we slowly make this thing more important, we get a better sense of what it is, and then having that sense of what it is, we can fill out the truly important moments in its history.
But the reason the scenes in particular matter toward that objective of what the great story of this object is, the reason those scenes matter is that the object is a passive thing, even if it has capacity and power. It must be wielded, right? Or interacted with, engaged. So in a way, it's kind of a punctuated evolution where you have large periods of dormancy, and the scenes, the big beats, are the ones where the hero, the villain, somebody finds the thing and does a thing with it. And that in some way either adds to the legend or alters the nature and properties of the thing they use for whoever takes it up next.
Well, there's two elements to it. One is that, yes, how it is used will change its legend. And so if it is used in specific ways, that starts to define what it is. But also, this being a powerful artifact, it can't help but exemplify certain things. So when you start out the game not knowing much about it, in your first couple of scenes, where you describe what's happening, you use those scenes, like we can say, oh, well, this element happened around this scene. This artifact must be a thing of that element. That's why it expressed itself. The idea is your artifact's been expressing itself all along. We're just finding out how it did.
That's why I think it's important, necessary even, to begin with a few designated, even if they're randomly generated, qualities.
Absolutely.
So that you know going into that first scene what truths you have to work with and then can build from and see what else reveals itself as you add in more truths of world and character to pit against it or engage it with.
Exactly. The way I have it written this is all just potential starting points, but the way I have it written is that each artifact, each player makes an artifact and they choose just at the beginning a source, a goal, and a weakness.
So three truths, three different categories, each of which can be built upon depending on how the scenes play out.
Exactly. Or new qualities can be discovered as well. That's absolutely fine. But I do think it's good to build out those qualities. I think that major themes of qualities need major scenes, but I think you can always expand out. And also, we're not just limited to expanding out the truths of these artifacts. We are also capable of expanding out the truths of the world.
Billy Mays, part of me wants to see it's like an interstitial intermissions, moments of Billy Mays just selling whatever the artifact we're working with is as it gains new qualities. So you get a commercial each time as it takes whatever things you've added onto and goes, hey, look what else it does this time. New version. Da, 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 and just riffs, right? I almost feel like that's the, in a way, this kind of piggybacks off the idea we had with Andrew's great train robbery game, where the culmination is the consequence of the story the group tells together and how well they convince an audience that their individual participation or elements of it are true or relevant and how much they get punished or rewarded according to how great a thief they were in that robbery, right? And in this sense, it's part of the brinksmanship here is that everybody participates in adding qualities to the game. But I know in particular with the group of individuals we play, that's the directions it would end in, yes?
Quite possibly, although I think I've got a good balancing idea that helps people be pretty much completely in charge of the development of their own artifact without keeping other people from having input. So this is the rough idea I have for it.
Okay.
Basically, after each person goes around, they play out the scene. Other people get to play actors or players in the scene. I'm thinking mostly Fiasco style, maybe rolling. Don't know. We'll find where the fun is on that one. I go back and forth on that one.
Usually with these types of collaborative stories or usually in a story where, I should say, when you're introducing multiple scenes and sequences with multiple characters, particularly over periods of time that can be that can have significant gaps or lacuna between them, or that can be sequential within the same lifespan of a character, because there's no hard and fast rule saying three scenes couldn't be one person wielding the artifact over their life, right? In the same
right,
sense.
Right, absolutely. That's very possible.
In the same sense that you could just as easily say 1,000 years apart each, just as a leap, or, you know, 1, 5, 1,000 within
you
three
also
scenes.
Are do not have to do things in order. No reason that you'd have to.
Because things can be lost or forgotten with time diminished or just unknown.
Exactly. So after each scene is done, the players at the table get to give the person whose scene it is a word that they think describes how that played out. A word or a quality. If they can't choose, random word generators are absolutely fine in this case. I don't think our crew would have a problem coming up with words on the fly. I think another crew might.
It strikes me, one of the interesting components of this type of system is that we could just have easily applied it to one of the old episodes we did years ago where we generated a pantheon.
Yeah.
We had a base tenet that even though they were known to have certain conflicting qualities, how those expressed over time changed.
And so what would happen is you'd have like the set of words, and the person whose scene it was would get to take some of those words. We'd probably in playtesting figure out how many of those words and whichever ones they wanted to be able to use later. The ones that are left, the entire table has the ability to start and think about how those words would apply to the world. If there was a bit player who came along, well, bit as far as this is thing, the bit player
in
this case.
I want to suggest let's say there are 3 to 4 pit players, so 3 to 4 artifacts. I want to suggest an idea to, one, encourage that, or to encourage that we don't just run the entire game with one person's artifact and not touch the others, but also to add an element of consequence and not scope creep, but urgency, right? So I think, let's say you start with 2 or 3 qualities, 3 qualities because you get 1 in each category, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that either there's a maximum amount at which point you become a world-threatening object because you do too much and become a destabilizing force in the known universe you guys have created, or it's just too tempting for too many people to try using it, and therefore you will likely be applied to something that is irrevocable or that breaks you in the process, whatever the logic of it is.
There will be pivotal moments. So just having taken these words doesn't actually affect anything yet. I was thinking there were 3 ways that the words could be used. The first is as an interrupt in an actual scene. As people are jointly working on this scene, someone can use a word that they've already got to change it to bring their own thing into the scene, etc. Or like if we do end up with rolling dice, the words could be used for a reroll, provided now that word affects the story. Don't know. Again, that's a playtest thing. But the other 2, words can be used to expand out. And once you use them, they're permanently a part of it. They can be used to expand out one of the qualities of the artifact. So now instead of being a sword that binds evil, now it's I don't know, give me a word.
Well, I think since we're gonna, let's just go with the standard, because magical swords against evil things are an old fantasy trope. So it's magic,
mm-hmm.
It's a sword, and it slays evil. Those are the starting qualities, correct?
Right.
So let's say where this is scene 1, whoever finds the magical sword of evil slaying, I think it turns them into a chicken. If they use a tool.
Absolutely. So in other words, in the scene, it actually could be, you know, that was one of the words, chicken. And now we take there'd have been a weakness too. And whatever that weakness would, it like might have originally been duration. And now you've augmented duration to say chicken.
Right. And it might be a literal sense. You turn into a poultry or fowl.
Mm-hmm.
Or it might simply be that you lose all sense of bravery.
And those are both ways that the person who's running that artifact could take it and add it in.
Right. My play is simply, as I'm channeling a little bit of Pablo here, you're getting into your whole story and I go, chicken. And then you have to figure out where that fits.
Exactly. Although if you alter someone's scenes, then that doesn't necessarily alter their artifact. They still are the arbiter of what gets to be permanently a part of their artifact.
Right. To play a little bit off of Link, maybe it's not in fact that the chicken is something you turn into, but a harbinger of what's to come, or the vengeful deity that punishes you for your actions.
Exactly. And if the person, if chicken is not one of the words picked up by the primary player of that artifact, then it can be incorporated into the world. Maybe it's not something that affects that artifact. It's something that affects anyone in that position.
They see you and they're terrified. They turn into chickens. They sprout feathers. There's a whole variety of ways you could rip.
Exactly. And then the final thing, and the thing that really limits the art. We'll see what's necessary for a limiter, because every one of these great artifacts has pivotal moments in its own story.
Okay.
I wrote down a list, instead of starting just a scene, if a player has enough words to buy one. And it'll be more words each time. They're only required to use one of the words, but they have to spend a certain number. So if you had like majestic, chicken, and dung heap, you could spend all those three on a thing, but you'd only have to take one of them as a word into the scene, but you'd still have to spend them to do the pivotal scene.
Another way to do this, to create a sense of, if not narrative coherence, but then a sense of when the tale has to be completed by, is that there are a certain number of scenes, and each artifact can only have one of each. So you have the artifact's creation scene, its destiny scene,
yes,
its downfall, as you face the metamorphosis, defining moment, etc. And once they're all played, it's done.
It's done. You don't have to necessarily, like, I was thinking a couple of those could be more than once, but if they are, they take the place of a different one. So there can only be one creation. There should only be one destiny. Downfall, metamorphosis, and defining moments can happen more than once, but you can only have five of these total.
Okay, as I was saying, I feel like there should be a total number.
Have two metamorphoses.
Sure.
But you'd have to sacrifice one of the others to do that.
I see. So effectively, you want to create a number of scenes, and then out of those, you can choose, but only up to the variety of scenes there are in total. And
right.
What that does, one, is it forces you to hop to others and build up their narratives too. I always like working with specifics, with pulling on a thread to see where it leads, because even though that sounds more restrictive at first, you have an easier time working with small details than you do with the unformed thought.
Right.
The moment you say the scene is a metamorphosis, you know that something must irrevocably change.
Absolutely. You may or may not know what you want to happen to your artifact going into it. You should have control over the consequences of it. But I think with our group, everyone would be pretty much fine with the narrative working out, even if it's not great. There's a reason why Downfall is one of those five, because a lot of these artifacts have pivotal moments of loss where they failed. Oh, the One Ring, Sauron fell. That's a mm-hmm. downfall, you know, and then it took thousands of years for him to manage to bring the ring and his own personal power back up. Downfalls are important parts because failure is an important part of the story.
I still think, I know the Rings of Power adaptation on Amazon Prime is much maligned. I get people have reasons for it. It's an adaptation. You know, all I will say is that adaptations are never the things they're adapted from. They can't be, as much right. as we would like them to be. The reason I bring it up, though, I think, and Ken and I were talking about this during the pacing exercise, is that Sauron in that version decides that, you know what, he was a terrible monster, and he would very much like to just retire and be a blacksmith. And Galadriel badgers him and yells at him and insists that he uses strength and powers, of which he has many, to do more and be more. And he keeps telling her, I don't want to. I want to be left alone. Let me just be. And she, for her own reasons of vengeance and necessity, she sees the collapse of the elven society, so you know what, their immortality feeling. There's so much urgency to the action she wants to take that she feels she needs him for, that she drives him to this place where he, having experienced his downfall, has a metamorphosis.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I've never read the Silmarillion. I don't personally care to. I know it is a fascinating exercise. But as a piece of narrative to just watch happen, it was interesting looking at the tragic hero force the villain back onto the stage.
Yeah, and there's lots of ways that you can take it in this kind of thing. Downfall can mean a lot of things. And if you've got a prophecy, downfall could be the point where the world was made permanently lesser because your prophecy partially came to pass. Or it could be the moment that your prophecy almost came to complete fruition and the forces of whatever that were trying to stop it, depending on what kind of prophecy it is, actually managed to stop it and save the day. You can also choose downfall or a destiny is the other one that can be downfall or destiny could be the final end of said artifact. You can decide, hey, after a certain point, it doesn't exist anymore. But we're probably not playing in the post destruction of it world, or maybe we are. Who knows? This is a world building exercise.
Look at the Epic of Gilgamesh. They seek the herb that will bring about immortality and the. I don't know if we'd call it downfall or destiny, but the moment where he takes a bath and a snake comes and steals the herb that will revive anything, immortality is lost. He had the artifact. He had the magical item that would change things forever. Mm-hmm. But he stopped paying attention. He was exhausted. He was fatigued. The hero let go, right? And the moment he let go, something else grabbed the power and made use of it for fascinating, if mundane, reasons. And you have... I'm wondering if the conversation with Napishtim, the navigator who found and gives Gilgamesh the directions to find this, would be in this case a defining moment or a destiny scene where he says, here's where you can find the artifact, right? So it's not even, the artifact isn't even in the scene per se, but the fact that its location is discovered.
I had not considered that, but it makes sense. The traditional idea of an artifact is one that is so powerful it bends the narrative. This is not a traditional idea, but like these are things that are so powerful they bend the narrative around them. A scene where the artifact is not in it, but it dominates what's going on in the scene, is a scene that tells you something about said artifact.
Well, look at the whole mythology around Kushi the Deathless, right? Mm-hmm. There are a variety of reasons, or Baba Yaga and either the hut with the chicken legs or the mortar and pestle. I bring up Kushi the Deathless in particular because most of the variations portray him escaping his soul on some external object that is buried within a variety of other things, and the whole journey is to find and destroy the thing. It doesn't even appear until the very end at its downfall, right? Mm-hmm. But discovering what it is, where it is, and how to break it is the story of it.
You can also set aside like the destiny as this is like the downfall or destiny can be the end point, or they can establish that there is no end point. The Master Sword will have a destiny to always rise up when it is needed, that it will always be there when evil rises. That is an appropriate destiny.
You could argue that the Deathly Hallows in Harry Potter had a purpose that they were created for. They served and had moments, defining moments and metamorphoses that their use resulted in. But in the narrative we experience through the series itself, it's how they're all brought back together and used.
Mm-hmm. You could treat the Deathly Hallows as a single artifact, or you can treat each of them as an artifact. The Elder Wand certainly seems to pick up enough aspects.
Sure.
The other two do not get as well defined, but that's because the Elder Wand, very specifically, the nature of its story is to be sought after via conquest, and that is how it gets its power, and that is how you achieve it. So by definition, we know about it, where the others can fall into people's hands. They're more subtle. And the invisibility cloak and the thing that's just a stone, it's going to be harder to know for certain. With them, their downsides are harder to see.
You know, it's fascinating. I was just, as you were saying that, I was thinking about in a way how Voldemort's entire Horcrux structure does mirror Kushi the Deathless intentionally. Mm-hmm. The whole narrative of the Horcruxes is, okay, where are the fragments of soul located and how do we get rid of them? And of course, per traditional narrative form, one of them is in the hero.
Yep. And Voldemort's soul itself is also another really good artifact example.
Right, because it corrupts whatever it's in. It is immortal until otherwise altered, and it presents a challenge for the heroes to make a decision off of. If one of their party is the vessel for him, a vessel for his soul, how do they extricate it? Because typically the rules of soul are that they're in the body or not. And when they're not in the body is dead.
Mm-hmm. Honestly, the only reason that didn't happen in Harry Potter is because of who did the killing.
Right. And some shenanigans narratively, but you know.
Although I should point out something very important. Since I work for Scholastic, I am apparently required to mention in conversations on social media about Harry Potter that I work for Scholastic, but I have absolutely no say about what's actually going on in it, like, you know, or what's being done with it or anything like that. This is apparently just your standard boilerplate conflict of interest kind of thing. I do not represent them. I am not advertising Harry Potter. I just happen to like the story quite a bit.
Right. And per the ongoing writer strike, we're not attempting to promote any particular properties. We're simply discussing it for the purposes of topicality.
Right. And since it did start as a book, we don't have to truly worry about the writer strike aspect of it, as we would in, say, The Matrix.
I have so many things to say that other people have already said that I will not use up this episode to discuss it. We have a conversation about AI coming with Nick Laurie, who was on the show ages ago. It took a while for us to coordinate a time. We'll go in depth about a lot of the ramifications of the technology then. So I will.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it's important stuff that's going on with this.
Yeah.
The story of Harry Potter as it appears in the books doesn't really, is no more than tangential to what's going on.
We are discussing it purely because there are numerous things that fit within the category of artifact. I jokingly, when I put in the episode title for the recording today, named it Legends and Lore, because that is one of the old, is it first edition or second edition, source material books for things of power that can be implemented in your story, right?
Mm-hmm.
Were deities in it too? It's been so long. I think they were.
I'm not sure I ever actually cracked that one. I remember artifacts from that era, and it's like, yeah, you don't have to listen to any of the rules when it comes to artifacts. Artifacts defy them, but they also are exceptionally dangerous to be around. This is back in the days when, you know, permanently mind controlling or de-leveling a character was commonplace and not considered a violation at the gaming table at all.
Dave, we're not supposed to permanently take things off of the characters.
Oh, no. I'm talking about specifically about mind control and removing things from the character in a way that makes them unplayable without any real thought towards how that's going to work.
Okay, so right. Autonomy and agency as opposed to suffering.
Exactly.
Fair enough. Okay. I just wanted to make sure we were on the same page there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No. Inflict suffering all you like. I tend to go with the thing that the idea that if it is on someone's character sheet from the start, if it is a stat or an aspect or a background, it's there because the character wants to explore it, not because they want it taken away. On the other hand, hit points, magical items that you find or anything like that, they're all fair game. And it's not like the other stuff's not fair game. It's just got to be a good story.
Okay. It was first edition. It was originally called Deities and Demigods. Mm. And I think it was both the fictional ones for the setting. And I know, I remember this. A portion of it was an attempt to adapt actual Earth mythologies to the system, which is, you can imagine, was as fraught as it sounds.
Oh, yeah.
I think is a fascinating artifact of the hobby that I was just taking a look to see where things evolved from.
Oh, yeah. It is always amazing watching like these design decisions and these game decisions that happened early on that in another era we'd be like, it's not just a passing fad kind of thing. In another era, we'd really say, it's not just, oh, this isn't fun for this generation. We'd say, oh, no, I can't believe you ever thought that would be fun. That just isn't where fun is found at the gaming table, which is not to say you can't adapt mythologies. You can. You just need to be aware of what you're doing.
That it's appropriation, and you have to acknowledge that. And
right. And use it well. Like, okay, so because I recently saw someone talking about it online, a good example would be, actually there are two examples that I've seen that are both, you know, out of, you know, Hebrew lore.
Sure.
And one's the Golem.
Mm-hmm.
And one is phylacteries. And D&D still, I think to this day, uses phylactery as a term for where a lich keeps their soul.
Correct. Funnily enough, the one that never penetrated into the mythos of fantasy to the extent that I think it could have is King Solomon's Ring. You have the Ars Goetia, which is another thing ascribed to Solomon. That's everywhere, where it's, his alleged book of demonology summoning, and there are real world attempts to capture that, I would say. Or there are physical artifacts on Earth that have that presumed to be a version of the Ars Goetia. Hard to verify because I personally have never encountered a demon that I know of, for instance. So I couldn't tell if the practitioner had used said book to conjure them.
And even if you could, would you trust them?
No. If that's one of the first things you bring up in conversation, hi, I'm Bob, I work in accounting, and I have a side business in demon summoning. It wouldn't be one of the weirdest things I've had at a conference said to me, but it'd be up.
Mm-hmm.
So the one I was going to bring up was King Solomon's Ring. And there are variations on the story, but the fundamental narrative goes that Solomon wanted to have an object that could, or a piece of wisdom that would make a happy man sad and a sad man happy. And one version of it has him punish a sergeant or a soldier under his service in classic Herculean fashion of the trials and tasks, right? And sends him off to, go on forever until he finds this thing and returns with it. Now, there are reasons why Solomon is said to have done this. Maybe the man was having relationships with one of Solomon's many wives. Maybe he tried to betray Solomon. There are variants on this, and the same level there are variants in Cinderella. But after a shaggy dog length of storytelling, eventually the soldier, the servant, the individual comes back and hands to King Solomon a ring. And Solomon looks at it in front of his full court and weeps, because inscribed on this very simple ring are three words, in Hebrew at least, Gam ze yavor, this too shall pass. What can make a happy man sad and a sad man happy? Mm-hmm. That all of it is transient. And the object is not magical at all.
It's wisdom.
But the wisdom it presents is transformative, because it is a knowledge you gain that once gained cannot be lost, and alters whoever holds it. And I feel like that's a good way to look at some of these real world, because when you introduce the idea that people are going to take things, artifacts, narrative ones, in the same way that Ken and I were talking about how hard it is to create fantasy or sci-fi settings without playing upon the languages and mythologies and histories of real world peoples and populations and cultures, when you introduce the idea of artifacts to storytelling game, eventually someone will port or adapt things that exist in the here and now.
They will. That's actually one of the reasons why I set this up the way I did, is I wanted what the artifact was to grow as you played, so that you couldn't start with an end in mind. You couldn't be saying, oh, well, I'm going to be telling the story of Excalibur, or I'm going to be telling the story of Sun Wukong's staff, or anything out of, or I'm going to be telling the story of, I don't know, the horses that from the stable that Hercules had to clean out. You don't know. Like you could use that as your very loosest starting point, but just the idea that you had about what they were, and let it grow its own legend rather than trying to follow or be the real world legend.
It's an interesting challenge. I think it's to kind of circle it back around to the, I don't want to call it a writing prompt, but to circle it back around to the act of trying to tell and create stories on the whole. The reason we push on this show to go to specific ideas, to go for two particular things and build from them, are so that, one, if you have the tread ideas, you will work them out and move beyond them.
Mm-hmm.
And two, that eventually you will hit upon a thing that surprises you, and that if you allow yourself to follow from that leap to the next, you may discover, if not an original idea, then at least a unique expression of one. So yes, to your point, it could be that these are, a stable of Pegasi, flying horses, or other thing mounts or creatures that don't usually, but can in this instance.
That's true. You could want your artifact could be the entire elven race. You're actually not limited in this game. It's probably like you probably would know from the beginning whether your artifact was a group of people or not, because it would be like, oh, a sword or a group of people or a prophecy or that kind of thing.
I'm trying to wrap my head around the idea of it being a group of people. What sense are you seeing that in?
Well, I guess it would depend. It would grow over the course of the story. When we play test this, which probably will not be tonight.
No.
You know, maybe one of us should do that just to see what happens. After all, this is still a prototype. We're still looking to find the fun. But I would be thinking along the lines of you could have a family, or you could have, I won't say gnomes because that'll drive you to distraction.
Let's look at Norse mythology for a moment. Often when a hero needs or wants a thing, they go to the dwarves.
Right. The dwarves would be a really good example. This is one where you could even choose something that has a real world name, because dwarves are in so much of fantasy. Just because you use the term doesn't mean you're talking about the ones from Norse mythology.
Or Tolkien, which is derivative from that. I think it's fellowship, right? Where one of the rewards in that system was the friendship of a community that would give you access to wisdom or knowledge or capacities that they would present to you because you had done something tremendous for them. And I could see in that sense where if the loosely used term your artifact is a community, then the story in part becomes, well, you know, actually, to go for a pop culture reference, Wakanda, right? Wakanda to the world at large becomes an artifact that they want to use within the Marvel Universe.
A nation could also be an artifact.
Right. I think more accurately, vibranium is probably the better. Actually, I think you could look at both stories. It could be the material, vibranium, or it could be the people who know how to use and can acquire the material and don't share that with others, which again...
You could run it either way. I actually don't want to put a limit on it. My thought is that the community is the more interesting of the one, because it's the one that can have a character. You're just adding properties to vibranium. You're not adding a character. Usually, but that's just the way my mind works. It should be possible to take a material and add a character to it.
I mean, if let's take your scenes and map it to this, the narrative of Wakanda. Let's go for Black Panther, right? Where would you say the downfall beat in that story is relating to the nation Wakanda?
Yeah, I would actually put the down because from what we know. Oh, should we be talking about movies?
I'm going to put my disclaimer in that we're talking about these in an analytical aspect. We're neither promoting or trying to sell existing properties. There's a writer's strike going on. It's just hard to talk about things without specifics to go into that our audience is at least to some extent familiar with.
I would say your downfall then.
Okay.
Your downfall is basically two things that I think line up very well together. It is the loss of the plant. Because it is also the loss of the clear line of kingship. It is the loss of one of the fundamental traditions of the community. Now, multiple movies play into that. It's not just one movie that you could look at and say, hey, that was the downfall. But if I were to point out one movie, it would be Black Panther.
I'm also thinking that a metamorphosis scene with the community could be the set of beats or narratives, the politics and conflicts surrounding the world's...
That would make a better metamorphosis than it would make a downfall. Well,
the thing I'm bringing in particular to highlight is that for a community, a metamorphosis might be the moment where the world at large wants them to join for reasons. Could be either noble or selfish, or perhaps a combination of both. So in the narrative of Wakanda within the Marvel Universe that we know of currently, one of the big conflicts is that the world doesn't just want vibranium, they want the wisdom and knowledge of the people of Wakanda to be shared. And that sparks a conflict within the community of whether or not we share this with the world at large, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that ripples into a number of other stories as well. But this external force alters the community irrevocably. It is not necessarily a downfall. It could lead to one, but it is a metamorphosis.
Absolutely. This is why you can absolutely take one more than once. You just have to, you know, give up another one, because you can have, like, you can be like, oh, I don't know whether it's a metamorphosis or a downfall. I'd rather call it a metamorphosis. And you might have two metamorphoses. So
I almost think back to, there's a variation on the Quiet Year. The Quiet Year, the core version, you're a settler, a group of settlers that travel into a new and strange land. And over the course of a year, things happen of increasingly terrible impact and import. There's a variation where you're an established community that feels the greater colonizing forces around you, threatening what you know and have. And I know we were leaning toward Fiasco as an engine to test this in, but part of me wonders if we're looking at a concept that is...
Oh, no, Fiasco is not the engine. Fiasco is just the description of like one of those styles of play that each person lays out a scene. The system has to do with using words to establish truths.
Okay. That's what I was getting at, because in a way where you're looking at something that is moddable onto or explorable through other engines. You could take the base premise of it, because I could see playing a game of Quiet Year where we use that initial setup of the community version of Quiet Year, where we use that basic setup to explore what is known about the community at the beginning and then go through the narrative of what happens to it from there.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I'm thinking. So what I envision coming out of a game of this is not just a bunch of artifacts. It's a world. That world you play in may or may not have those artifacts, depending on the time that you put that you set it in. If all those artifacts had a downfall,
you the lens of particular objects within it that were pivotal.
Exactly. And you're not just defining those artifacts. The words that don't get taken up by the player are used to define other things that happened in that scene and establish them as part of the world. If Loki, to, you know, shamelessly rob from Norse mythology again, shows up in one of these stories and tricks a bunch of characters out of the artifact, you know, the players have the option of establishing Loki as an important and pivotal part of this world. Use a word to define some of the things he does. Others may bring him back in. Over the course of it, we establish things that have happened in this world and players that are not the artifacts themselves and yet are very important to what's going on. And hopefully this world takes on a life in addition to these artifacts.
Part of me wants to, I mean, I was joking when I named the episode Legends and Lore, but part of me wants to lean more toward the idea of legend than artifact for one particular reason. I think artifacts suggest, and as I said earlier, like a moment or two ago, object. But I think we're discussing not just a thing in terms of an inert material or substance or created thing, but individuals, groups of people. And I think the legends and lore surrounding them.
I think that you are right. Because all of the ones I go to as an example are not just one thing. The Master Sword isn't just a sword. It's a prophecy. The One Ring isn't just a ring with a lot of power. It's the Dark Lord.
Right. And in that same sense, Loki and Wakanda are not reducible to three words.
Right.
I think when you emphasize that it's legends and lore about a community or an individual, it's a question of what legends and lore are we bringing to the fore and exploring, with the understanding that you're not trying to reduce an individual or a community or even a mythic thing.
Right. And again, I really do think this should be played in a fantasy setting, starting with an ill-defined people who are not real world. Per se, maybe very loosely influenced by the real world, but that's about it.
That's an interesting challenge.
Like, we shouldn't be using this game to play the overall story of, you know, the Native Americans or a specific tribe. That's not how this game should play. This game should have a cooperative and dynamic growth that goes places that no one can predict, and it would be bad to try to start out with a map.
I just think it's an interesting, and the reason I keep falling back to this challenge is that I think it is an inevitable inclination of, particularly in a lower, arguably lower stakes, at least from the point of entry game, as opposed to, you know, a published work or presented public work, right? So to give a little context, it'd be one thing to try this exercise at the table with a bunch of friends or online, you know, Zoom call or whatever. It's another thing if we were to try recording as a podcast, because I think even if the intent is to be sensitive and aware, it's so easy to fall into the tropes and material known through pop culture, through online, right? So I'm wondering how you design a system that pushes against that or entices.
How does the quiet year keep that from happening? There's nothing that says you can't use the quiet year and draw in it to describe, I don't know. Okay, now I'm blanking because I wasn't going to use the bad term. I was Eastern European, known for caravans and moving about. I just don't want to use the pop culture.
The Romani or the Roma, I think.
Yeah. Thank you. That's the term I couldn't remember. I wanted to give the actual term for them. I would think it would be a really bad idea to use the quiet year to map out something that happens to a bunch of them, or to start with some people that are like that and end up making them. There's nothing in the quiet year that stops you from doing that, just the knowledge that it's a bad idea.
So I'm gonna recommend to you, this is a system Ken introduced to us. We placed this a while back, Lancer. And the core idea of Lancer is you have giant robots in space and you fight space battles with giant robots that you make bigger and better. It's not a new trope by any means, but they deliberately set out the kind of stories they would like you to explore and that the system was built around to engage with. And I am seeing more of this now within this design space, more so I think initially with the indie environment, but I think as you look at the titans of the industry and their attempts to adapt and modify to a combination of social and market pressures, you're seeing efforts where they are revisiting old systemic and mechanical tropes and seeing what should stay and what should go, as well as how to present the use and implementation of these to tell better, more respectful stories, right? And Lancer is deeply explicit about it, which is why I think it'd be interesting for you to look at how they lay out for you the kind of stories they have in mind when they built the system. I think fundamentally with any type of engine you create to tell stories, and this is just role-playing games, tabletop, computer, video game, whatever, they are storytelling engines. Fundamentally, they tell a story, and then they create a story out of your experience of the story they tell and your engagement with it. Books are the same thing. There's a story told by the writer, writers, et cetera, and then another one emerges out of your experience and interactions with it. I mean, I am experiencing this on a technical end with putting together the reader packet for the book, because I use some unusual narrative mechanisms. And part of me wonders whether I should even preface to the book, here's what these symbols and objects will mean in the text, right? But you do see, I've seen books I picked up now that have trigger warnings, right? And I say this without any judgment as to what a trigger warning is and its use, but this is a phenomenon I see now. Mm-hmm. And it's, I think, one of the best implementations I've seen from a system and a game version was the game I Was a Teenage Exocolonist. It's a little spoilery, but, you know, I don't think it ruins the game at all. In the menu, there is a drop-down engagement system where it says, hey, these types of story beats are going to happen. One, putting this here before you even start the story to let you know, but I believe there's also a set of toggles where you can shut those beats off. I personally didn't do anything, but I was fascinated that that level of user and control was available. I've not seen it often. So I guess I throw the challenge to you as someone creating a storytelling engine in this exercise today to decide what level of upfront, I don't want to call it mission, but intent you want to make clear to the players, not just in terms of what mechanically the system will tell, but the kinds of stories you hope they'll tell.
I would say it this way, because the system is a very dynamic one, that, mm-hmm. that ideally this is made without an endpoint in mind, that you do not know the words you're going to get. You can choose the ones you like of the pool that you get. And there probably should be a system in for trading in words you don't want for words that you do. But because it's cooperative, shared, but no one moment is defining, except for like those five for each one. I think the biggest one is to adapt the one that's at the end of every movie ever, or at least every movie for the past 50 years, with an extra caveat at the end. And that that disclaimer is the events in this are fictitious. Any similarities to, you know, real people are unintended. And then the caveat you add at the end of that is, now mean it.
I think it was, I was just thinking back to our interview with Jay Dragon, the creator of Wanderhelm. It's a while back, and we will get around to sharing the playtest as well as our extrapolation from it, because that's an example of a system that had an intent, one of which was to have no violence. And it was a fascinating challenge for us as a group of players in a collaborative story, trying to tell a story without violence.
Mm-hmm.
Because one way or another, we always get there.
Yeah. My goal with this system is to help create a world that you haven't, you know, that is personal to the players at the table, that it creates a world that you can explore, that you can play on. It's a world building exercise, like Microscope, like
The Quiet Year is another example too. Sure.
Quiet Year. It should come with the kind of disclaimers that those come with. You can't, at a certain point, you can't stop people from bringing things into it. You can just recommend that they don't. And I think in that regards, because it is so open-ended, a simpler warning is better. And I do think that this very, very much should be played with a red card system.
Oh, I agree. Whether it's something that you have as a group implemented before, or you can borrow from one of the many variations in place where prior to the play, you as a group say, hey, here's the things I would love to see, find, or explore, and here's the things that I am not okay with.
Yeah, because when you get down to it, you are replicating a mythology. It doesn't have to be a real-world mythology, but if you're just playing into types, there's a lot of dark stuff that happens in a mythology that it might be better to not explore if the people at the table are not comfortable with it. And if they are comfortable with it, well, you know your table best. But a red card system helps you get some of that stuff out of the way. Or one we usually do on the things, the musts and the nevers.
Yes. And I think we've never really needed to implement the middle ground of maybe, because that is, it's so hard in the moment to adjudicate that. And when we play the game of pulling on threads to see where it leads, is that you may not always like the surprise you find, right? And that is why you still, as a group and individual, should maintain the capacity to say, here's the thing I found. Do I wish to introduce this? Or do we reach a point in the exploration where it goes in a direction I feel interested in and comfortable with or not?
Right.
I was listening to the radio the other day, and there was another piece of research talking about the importance of social play to us when we're young in terms of negotiating the games we create, the rules around them, the boundaries established, and when we trespass those, and how to say, okay, hey, I think this is not fair. I think this is fair. I want to do this instead. I don't want to do that. So much of that conversation is easy to lose if we don't create spaces in which to have them.
Mm-hmm. That is one of the things. When people know where the boundaries are, they walk right up to them. When they don't know where the boundaries are, they actually play it over cautiously. Sometimes you might find that saying, I don't want to go here, actually frees the table up to explore a lot more.
Right.
We've often said limitations breed creativity.
It removes the easiest thought, or the, I don't want to call it the laziest, but the one that doesn't let you, okay, I'm not phrasing this right. So when we lay out the exercise of pulling on threads, part of the reason that works so well is that as you lay down more threads, you have more material to draw from and more specifics to work with.
Right.
And it's why a group of, say, 3 to 4 works so well in these circumstances, because even if you don't entirely know where an idea will go, someone else can rein it in or pull it in a direction that is fruitful. And part of the reason I do this show and occasionally bounce pieces of the story around with you guys, because even if I have a gut impulse as to where things could go, it's useful and beneficial to hear where someone else runs with it. And I think it is necessary as creatives to be able to get into that and comfortable with that environment, where even if you are unsure or uncertain of a thing, you can present it and say, hey, let's play with this and see where it leads and where what points we want to prune and trim it. And these kinds of games, even if we never end up designing them, simply as exercises, are a good tool for us to explore individual concepts and see where, as tropes and narrative techniques and tools, we often fall in terms of using them, relying upon them, ignoring them, playing with them. The discussion about and development of the idea is as important as the idea itself.
Yeah.
And I think that part of why we often go into these world-building exercises is that they serve as a good starting place to explore things we are uncertain of.
A good story can excite us, yes. But the best ones, fiction or not, compel, inspire, or drive us toward the hope that we need for a better life. Remember, you don't need to know everything right now, but you do need to write. So make sure to like, review, and subscribe to us at Here Be Tigers. And until next time, take life by the tail.